Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
This is VOA Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports. South Africa won its second gold medal Friday at the Commonwealth Games in Australia, where swimmer Chad Laclos was crowned champion in the men's 50 meters butterfly event. The 25-year-old athlete from Durban clocked 23.37 seconds. It was the fifth Commonwealth Games title of Chad's very successful international career. He's also won four Olympic medals, two silver at the 2016 Rio Games, and a gold and a silver at the 2012 London Games. Chad's Olympic gold came in the 200 meters butterfly. Dylan Carter of Trinidad and Tobago won the silver Friday in the 50 meters butterfly, and another South African, Ryan Kutsi, won the bronze medal. South Africa's first gold medal at Gold Coast 2018 came Thursday when Henry Schoeman won the men's triathlon in 52 minutes and 31 seconds.
I've had a fantastic start to the year. And, you know, last year post-Olympics, I had a bit of a down to come here and win Commonwealth Games. I'm just so truly happy with my performance. I'm happy for my family. I race for my country. And I'm just so happy with that.
A happy South African athlete, Henry Schoeman, the Commonwealth Games champion in the men's triathlon. The Indian Ocean island of Mauritius also won its first medal at Gold Coast 2018, and it was captured by female weightlifter Marie Hanitra Roya Ranaivasoa. Marie won a silver medal in the women's 48-kilogram event. After two full days of competition, host Australia is dominating the Commonwealth Games medals table with a total of 36 medals, 14 gold, 9 silver, and 13 bronze. England is next with 18 medals, 9 gold, 6 silver, and 3 bronze. In more Commonwealth Games news, Canadian shooter Robert Pitcairn is set to become the oldest athlete in Games history next week. Pitcairn is preparing to make his Commonwealth Games debut at 79 years and 9 months of age. Robert will compete in the full bore shooting events, which start on Monday. He says, and I quote, "My goal is to stand on the podium with my partner, Nicole Rossignol, in the pairs event, and then again for the individual event. I trained hard. I'm aiming for that, and I'm going to get them." Go get them, Robert Pitcairn, soon to become the oldest Commonwealth Games athlete in history. By the way, Robert Pitcairn is a former commercial pilot. You need good vision for both. You need good vision to be a pilot, and you need good vision to be a world-class shooter. That's the common denominator. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. In African football news, FIFA says a 2026 World Cup bid evaluation task force will visit Morocco between April 16th and April 19th. FIFA says the five-member task force will visit the Moroccan cities of Marrakesh, Agadir, Tangier, and Casablanca. The Moroccans are competing against a joint bid by Canada, Mexico, and the United States for the right to host the 2026 World Cup. The FIFA task force will visit those three countries before traveling to Morocco. Their itinerary calls for visits to Mexico City, Toronto, Atlanta, and New York next week between April 9th and April 13th. FIFA will announce the host of the 2026 World Cup in Moscow on June 13th, one day before this year's World Cup kicks off in the Russian capital. Russia will host Saudi Arabia in the opening match. Joining us now with more African football news is reporter Samson Omale. Good evening, Samson.
Good evening to you, Sonny. We begin with the CAF Confederations Cup, as five former African champions are among 32 clubs involved in CAF Confederations Cup playoffs first leg this weekend as they chase group places. Raja Casablanca of Morocco, Enyimba of Nigeria, V Club of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kara of Congo Brazzaville, and ASEC Mousa of the Ivory Coast are all in the race. V Club and ASEC have home advantage, and the other three one-time title holders play away first as Confederations Cup last 32 winners face CAF Champions League last 32 losers. Kenyan champions Gomahia will be without Ugandan left-back Geoffrey Walushimbi when they take on South Africa's SuperSport United in the first leg of their CAF Confederations Cup playoffs in Machakos on Sunday. Dylan Kerr, head coach of Gomahia, believes they are in the competition to win it.
We've got a massive task ahead of us because even though SuperSport are doing indifferently in the league this year to where they usually are, and they've got rid of their manager just recently, they've got something to prove.
Staying with football news, a Zambian national team coach, Wetsin Nyerinda, has told the Football Association of Zambia that they can fire him if they want to. The coach has challenged his employers to take a bold step and fire him, saying he will not appear before the technical committee, which was called to review his performance. According to the Times of Zambia, Nyerinda has asked the Football Association of Zambia to do as they wished and that the technical committee meeting scheduled for this week was unnecessary. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria.
Thanks, Samson, and I hope you have a sporty weekend. I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. An update now on Mohamed Salah. After scoring his 38th goal of the season Wednesday in Liverpool's 3-0 victory over visiting Manchester City in the UEFA Champions League, Salah left the pitch in the second half with a suspected groin injury. Reports from England say the 25-year-old Egyptian star has spent time in a hyperbaric oxygen chamber in an effort to return to full fitness ahead of Liverpool's trip to Goodison Park on Saturday to play Everton. Liverpool's German manager, Jurgen Klopp, says he won't risk using Salah against Everton unless the 2017 African Footballer of the Year is 100% fit.
I cannot make Mo available because it's a derby. I would never do that. It's not possible. You cannot push a player through a game only because, I don't even think any of our supporters wanted to do that. So if he's a doubt, he will not be involved. That's how it is. That's all. That's how it is with all of them. If they are not 100% fit, they cannot be involved. No, but that's all. But I would not rest the player with absolutely nothing. So with absolutely no problem, because that's our situation. We play. We are used to play all 3 days. That's not the problem. And, nothing to do with Mo or any other player. It would be always the same decision. You are available. You're involved. You're not available. You're not involved.
Jurgen Klopp and the Reds of Liverpool are involved in a tight race for second place in the English Premier League. The lads from Liverpool are currently third on the table with 66 points, 2 points behind Manchester United. And Tottenham Hotspur follows closely behind in fourth place with 64 points. Manchester City is the runaway leader with 84 points. And if Man City can defeat rival Man U on Saturday, Man City will clinch their fifth Premier League title. Now, Man City has to win the game at home to wrap up the title. A draw means their celebrations are put on hold for a while. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. The U.S. women's national soccer team defeated regional rival Mexico Thursday night 4-1 in a friendly match played in the southern U.S. city of Jacksonville, Florida. Alex Morgan scored two goals for the USA, the world's top-ranked women's team. And let's give a sunny side of sports salute to Carly Lloyd, FIFA's two-time World Female Player of the Year. Carly came on as a second-half substitute for the American women and scored in the 54th minute. It was her 99th international goal. 19-year-old Mallory Pugh had the other goal for the USA. Mallory was just named the National Women's Soccer League's Player of the Week. Mallory is based right here in the Washington area with the Washington Spirit Club. Katie Johnson scored Mexico's goal in the 64th minute. The USA and Mexico will play another friendly match on Sunday in Houston, Texas. The American women are unbeaten so far in 2018, with wins over Mexico, Germany, Denmark, and England, and a draw against France. Well, sometimes football, what Americans call soccer, is more than just a game. It's a way of life that expresses the true spirit of the team and its community. That's the underlying message behind Amy Bass's new book, One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought a Divided Town Together. It's the inspiring story of a group of teenage Somali refugees in the northeastern U.S. state of Maine who joined the Lewiston High School soccer team and overcame prejudice and other obstacles to help the squad win the 2015 state championship. In her conversation with VOA's Adam Phillips, Bass, a history professor at the College of New Rochelle, said that one goal is actually about two games.
The game is the game of soccer, the most global of sports, but it's also about a very specific game that took place in the fall of 2015 when the Lewiston Blue Devils went to seek their first state championship title in soccer with a very different kind of roster.
Tell me a bit about Lewiston.
Lewiston, Maine was a largely French-Canadian town, a former factory town, textile industry. The bottom fell out when factories closed and moved out of the Northeast. So it was a town that had seen better days. And in 2001, a couple and then a couple hundred and then a couple thousand Somali refugees found their way to Lewiston, taking advantage of available apartments. It had high vacancy rates and good schools and a safe community to begin to continue their lives and raise their families in the United States. And some of these kids found their way to the soccer team. Soccer's a passion. And this story is about this coming together of community and family and team in this quest for this state title and what it means to this community and what it represents. You know, community is not just about statistics. It's also about a feeling of home and a feeling of belonging. And that's a priority here.
Still, you said there were lots and lots of growing pains, at least at first. I mean, it's hard to think of two cultures that are more different than the Somalian culture these people came from and the native New Englanders they found in post-industrial Lewiston, Maine.
No, I mean, on the surface is very much a fish out of water story. You know, people's reaction is, why are there Africans in Maine? It's such a cold state. It's an overwhelmingly white state. In the early days, you had moments like when the former mayor wrote an open letter to the Somali community saying, you know, we support you, but please tell your friends and family to stop coming. We can't have any more. And so that's a painful moment, but it's followed by a coming together, a giant rally that the community puts together to sort of say, no, you know, we are many and we are one.
So there's something a bit more to it than either the two groups polarizing or sort of becoming one homogeneous group without distinctions.
It's really a negotiation amongst different peoples to find a path forward. And there's a lot of culture clash, but Maine has the oldest median age in the United States. And to have folks who are interested in laying roots and raising families and having their families raise families was a shot in the arm that Lewiston needed in terms of attracting business and attracting industry in a city that hadn't seen that for a very long time, in a state that doesn't see that.
Of course, it's not really equivalent, but both the Lewiston community and the Somalis had both experienced trauma and displacement. The Somalis, obviously, because of war and famine, etc. But the Lewiston folks had also been through a lot. I could understand, perhaps, why, at least at first, there might have been some resentment against the refugees.
Lewiston has had decades and decades of white intergenerational poverty, has some of the poorest neighborhoods in Maine. And there is that sort of competitive, what are these new people getting that I'm not getting?
So all this is great background to know about the growth and integration within the Lewiston High School. I know there were lots of racist slurs and things that opposing teams used, but it seems like people got together pretty well within Lewiston itself.
Somalis started coming onto the team in the mid to early 2000s, just a few at a time. And the book sort of details some of those early players coming on and different kinds of accommodations that the athletic department had to think about in terms of, you know, diet and Ramadan and how to integrate players and create relationships amongst players. But slowly, the Somali players began to dominate the varsity roster.
I know that soccer wasn't such a huge deal at all in Lewiston before the Somalis arrived, then began to really shine, correct?
Lewiston, it's a championship hockey town. It's a championship cheerleading town. And slowly, soccer was becoming a marquee sport. They make it to the state championship in 2014. They suffer a devastating loss. And, you know, the day after that loss, the next season begins because they are determined that they're going to be the ones to bring this city its first championship in this sport. And it's really an all hands on deck kind of effort. We have the high school coaches working, but the families and the supporters of the team. We see community organizations, you know, Somali founded community organizations are sponsoring soccer programs and supporting youth. We see a bridging of cultures amongst coaches, you know, the longtime head coach of the high school team hiring Abdi Jabbar Hersey, the first Somali hired by the Lewiston Athletic Department. He is the son of Abdullahi Abdi, who is sort of the coach of everyone in the city, a mentor of everyone. So it's really about thinking about what these kids in this community bring to the game. And it isn't that soccer replaces hockey in this main city. It's that now it's a hockey and soccer town.
I know the culture of soccer in Somalia is very different than the American competitive sort of individualistic style that we're used to. And that really helped bring a great spirit to the Lewiston team.
You know, they work very hard to make the team a team of the whole. You know, the bench players are as prioritized as the players who are on the field. This is a team who scores in such awesome capacity that as soon as they're up by five, the starters are pulled and the next line goes in and the next line goes in. And soccer becomes something that you have to work really hard at. You know, 25 years ago, soccer was something that you might have done to get into shape for your hockey season. And now if you want to play soccer and you want to be on the varsity roster in Lewiston, you better be playing all day, every day and studying the game and really taking it in because it's no longer an easy team to just roll onto.
Give me a sense of the build-up to the epic game of 2015, the championship game. There must have been a lot of anxiety among Somalis and native-born Mainers alike, not to mention the townspeople.
Yeah, there was tremendous pressure with the 2015 championship, and I think my favorite chapter in the book is going through with each of the players about what that morning was like waking up in Lewiston and thinking about the game that lay ahead of them and the pressure of trying to bring this city its championship. But I think that the most remarkable thing about that day is that there's 4,500 people in the bleachers of Fitzpatrick Stadium. You know, it's the most ever to sit for a soccer game in Maine. It's more people than show up the following week for the football championship. And you have those kinds of numbers. You're not talking just about the parents of the players and the friends of the players. You're talking about the community, a significant representation of the community. So they got to experience for those 90 minutes what it was like to be together, to have a we moment instead of an us versus them moment.
Sounds like a classic American success story. The immigrants who become Americans seemingly overnight almost.
I think that this story is very different because usually we talk about assimilation and Americanization and fitting in. And I think that Lewiston is really a negotiation in which all sides have to learn from each other to find paths forward together. It isn't about erasing who you are when you arrive to fit into this thing that we call America. It's about how to still know language and culture and food and tradition while living in America, and how you can take something like a common passion for a sport and use that. I mean, one of my favorite things that the players say about coach is that he doesn't care where they're from as long as they pass the ball. You know, that's a great sort of daily mantra to take away. If you're doing what you're supposed to be doing together, you can learn from that and live with that.
Give me a couple of examples, maybe of a Somali immigrant or refugee and a native-born Lewiston person who really exemplifies this sort of coming together or mutual negotiation that you're talking about socially.
I think one of the most interesting characters in the book is it's Shobo Saban, someone who played for Lewiston in 2007, 2008, 2009, as the roster was beginning to fill with Somali kids. And he was the only Somali on his eighth grade team. He made friends with Johnny McDonough, a fellow teammate who had sort of taken an interest in Shobo because he was wearing soccer jerseys to school every day. He's really one of the first kids that forges this path of how to hang out with people who aren't exactly like him. So I think that those kinds of examples of team playing together, being together, and creating relationships that work on the field and off the field is a heartening thing to look at.
And you mentioned this sort of mutual accommodation we found on and off the team within the high school really translated into sort of palpable prosperity for the town. It's sort of on its way back now. These two comeback stories sort of reflect each other, don't they?
Yeah, it's thriving in a way that I think city planners hadn't envisioned. There's all of these entrepreneurial dreams that are coming to life when you walk down Lisbon Street. You have a mix of variety stores and grocery stores and clothing shops and tax services and, you know, an upscale coffee house on the one hand, mixed in with stores that are selling 40-pound bags of rice and green bananas and hijabs. It's a global experience to walk down Lisbon Street. It is a Main Street USA, but in a way that probably the city administrators didn't envision.
You have so much passion for this subject. It seems like it's really been very inspiring for you to work on all this.
It has. This project started as conversations about Syrian refugees and, you know, was the United States open or not open to be sort of that place that people could see as a beacon and who the United States is, because those conversations are now framed in terms of quotas and walls. And so I think that whether it be a soccer story or the story of this obscure season for this obscure team in Maine, America needs to remember who it is.
That was Amy Bass, a history professor at the College of New Rochelle and the author of One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought a Divided Town Together. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. I'm Sonny Young in Washington. And you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. I encourage our VOA listeners to follow The Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Once again, that Twitter handle, @VOA Sunny Sports. My Facebook friend, Mike Houle, sent me this fun Olympic fact. 122 years ago on this day, on April 6th, 1896, the Olympic Games, a long-lost tradition of ancient Greece, were reborn in Athens 1,500 years after being banned by Roman Emperor Theodosius I. At the opening of those Athens Games in 1896, King Georgios I of Greece and a crowd of 60,000 people welcomed athletes from 13 countries to the International Sports Festival. And the Olympics have certainly grown in size since those Athens Games of 1896. And mark your calendars, VOA Olympic fans. The next Olympics will be held in Tokyo, the Japanese capital, in 2020. And the 2020 Olympics are scheduled from July 24th to August 9th. And that wraps up the April 6th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer Nick Ivanoff. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it. We'll
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In an effort to limit resources that fuel the civil war in South Sudan, the United States Department of Commerce has imposed licensing requirements on 15 of the country's oil-linked entities whose revenues have contributed to the ongoing crisis in South Sudan. This means that all exports, re-exports, and transfers to these entities of any items originating in the United States will now require an export license. According to the World Bank, with oil revenue accounting for almost all of its exports and around 60% of its gross domestic product, South Sudan is the world's most oil-dependent country. Through this action, the United States hopes to increase pressure to end the country's five-year-old civil war and the resulting humanitarian crisis. In December 2013, less than 18 months after it declared its independence from Sudan, a power struggle between President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar spiraled into civil war. The continued fighting has cost the lives of tens of thousands of people and led to a devastated economy, human rights abuses, hunger, and malnutrition. One-third of the population has been displaced by the violence, nearly 2 million internally and more than 2 million who have fled to neighboring countries. The 15 entities include South Sudan's Ministries of Mining and Petroleum and state oil firm Nile Petroleum. Also included are Dar Petroleum Operating Company, oil distributor Nayakek and Sons, Greater Pioneer Operating Company, Juba Petrotech Technical Services, and Sud Petroleum Operating Company. The listed entities are a source of substantial revenue for the government of South Sudan, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. Unfortunately, the South Sudanese government and corrupt official actors use this revenue to purchase weapons and fund irregular militias that undermine the peace, security, and stability of South Sudan, rather than support the welfare and current emergency food needs of the South Sudanese people. The government of South Sudan can do better, said Heather Nauert. As the largest donor of aid to South Sudan, the United States is proud to uphold humanitarian values and deliver vital assistance. The government of South Sudan must not squander that generosity and should take concrete steps to provide for the vast needs of the South Sudanese people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
This week on VOA's Encounter, Carol Castiel and her guests examine U.S.-China relations in the wake of tit-for-tat tariffs, as well as China's theft of intellectual property, President Xi Jinping's increasing authoritarian rule, and Beijing's role in curbing North Korea's nuclear ambition. That's Encounter, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscasts covering Africa and the world news. Tune in on top of each hour, 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.